Somebody's gonna introduce.
Anybody for leave?
Somebody's gonna introduce.
Who's introducing?
No.
Seth.
Hi.
It's a great pleasure, Dr. Seth Lloyd.
Thank you.
I hope the length of the talk will be shorter.
Yeah.
People were going to think that I was going to say the talk yesterday, but I was really thinking about cross-country ski hiking with Seth.
Yeah, when marathon does not describe the cross-country ski, 14-hour cross-country ski over starting at midnight across the Caldera, the Hamas Mountains, to the San Antonio Hot Springs. Yes, that was a marathon. Yesterday's 3-hour talk was nothing by comparison. Okay, so I'm Seth Lloyd. I'm from MIT. I'm a professor of quantum mechanical engineering there. You know, quantum mechanical engineering department. He didn't even get a laugh, so now true, right? I'm going to stop saying.
I'm not kidding, though. You're really mechanical engineering.
Yeah. Well, and I guess I sent a title to abstract, but somehow didn't manage to make it through. So what I just want to do about today are quantum limits to measuring space-time geometry. Now, yesterday, this 3-hour marathon was about a theory or a way of an attempt to derive quantum gravity together with elementary particle physics from quantum computation. And today's talk is really the prologue to yesterday's talk. So today I will provide the motivation for the talk I gave yesterday. Had I given this talk prior to that, perhaps it wouldn't have taken 3 hours. But what I'd like to talk to you today. So the idea, the basic idea from this, the slogan of this whole course is it from qubit to paraphrase Wheeler. The idea is, what I'm going to talk about today is, so when we measure space-time geometry, space-time geometry is measured using quantum mechanical systems, right? So, because everything is quantum mechanical. And what we use to measure space-time geometry are quantum mechanical systems. Atomic clocks, we send pulses of light, GPS satellites are themselves quantum mechanical systems. And what I'd like to talk about today is to give a review of the quantum mechanical limits to measurement. So how accurately can you measure something like a distance or a time, given a certain number of resources, okay? And then I'd like to, at the end, I'll actually combine this with some just ordinary classical general relativity to derive a new limit, which I call the quantum geometric limit, which is a, it's complementary to the holographic bound. Bounds the number of bits that you can put in some volume, free volume of space-time. Effectively, this quantum geometric limit bounds the number of events that can occur in a 4-volume of space-time. So it's kind of like, if you think of the holographic bound as having to do with the spatial computational complexity, the number of bits that you have. This is about the time computational complexity, the number of ops you can have. Okay. So that's should be an Orphic statement at the moment, but by the end you'll know what I mean. For those, I know that this informal 3-hour seminar yesterday was announced rather late, and I saw lots of people didn't come, and I agreed with some people here that after this colloquium, maybe a lot of people are here, so I can tell a little bit more about deriving quantum gravity from quantum gravitation. But I won't do that here. What instead I will do here is I'm going to I'm going to derive limits to GPS, is basically what I want to do here. Suppose time goes in this way, and GPS works by having a bunch of clocks that are moving through time, which, as always in general relativity, goes up. Okay? And so the clocks tick, 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 and then at a later time they read some other value. Okay? Here's another clock that's moving in another direction in space-time, and it's ticking at perhaps a different rate because their clocks are moving with respect to each other, with respect to some reference frame. So like that. Okay, here's yet a third clock that's going off in this direction. Tick, 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 tick. Starts out at 5. Ends up at 5:30. Okay, Now, it's the way that GPS measures space-time geometry is not merely by having clocks, which in GPS are contained in GPS satellites, okay? They send signals to each other at the speed of light. So at tick number one, this clock sends out a signal at the speed of light, and at tick number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, this clock receives a signal. Here's another signal going off at the speed of light. Here's another signal like this. Okay. And so when the signal, the satellites record when they sent the signal out, and the people receiving them record on their own clock when they received that signal. Okay. A detector clicks, and they say, "Aha! This detector clicked at this time, and I received the signal at this time." And as Einstein pointed out, with this generalized picture of clocks, inertial clocks moving through space, sending signals to each other, allows you to recover the geometry of some four volume of space-time because the clocks are moving to some degree of accuracy. Okay, so this is a four volume, I'll just call it, it's a sort of the spatial extent, the width of the three volume it is x, and the length of it is, we'll call it t. So T will be the length of this four volume. So think of this as a four volume with clocks moving in it. And so basically, most of what I'm going to do during this colloquium is to derive the quantum mechanical limits to how accurately you can measure space-time geometry by this kind of setup. Okay? And for this, of course, I'm talking about GPS clocks here, but these clocks could be as large as planets or galaxies, or they could be, for to measure very large distances, or they could be small as elementary particles, okay? Because quantum mechanics isn't going to care in terms of driving limits to measure. And in particular, the resolution to which I can measure this is a function of the number of ticks plus clicks, right? So ticks of clocks, ticks of detectors, sorry, ticks of clocks, clicks of detectors, that's hard to say. Ticks and clicks. Ticks of clocks and clicks of detectors. Those are the elementary events from which we're going to try to reconstruct the space-time geometry. And in particular, the kind of density of events is basically number of ticks and clicks divided by the whole formula, right? So this gives you the kind of average resolution to which you can measure space-time geometry. Alright? And all I'm going to do is just go through the quantum mechanics of this, which is very straightforward and actually quite well known, so some people will be bored. But I thought it'd be fun, because it's actually, this particular derivation doesn't normally get made very often. So, any questions about this? This is what I intend to do. So everybody happy with this? This is the resolution here? Yeah.
Are you going to take into account the back reaction and the method?
No, I'm not going to do that. Oh, well, I will eventually, yeah. That's how I'll derive this in a very semi-classical way. At the end, that's how I'll derive this geometric limit. In fact, now that I've drawn this picture and told you that there is a limit on the number of ticks and clicks you can cram into this volume, I bet by the time I actually derive it, you will have figured out what it is already. Okay?
It's not a question.
Yeah. So the question was, am I going to talk about the back reaction of these quantum mechanical things on the metric? And I'm not going to do that. So I do have a theory of back reaction of quantum mechanical things on the metric, but that's not related to this right here. Yeah.
It's going to be ticks and clicks of ordinary matter?
Whatever quantum mechanical stuff is there. So actually, if gravity is itself quantized, okay, right, if there are gravitational waves there, and they're going to be used to actually perform part of the measurement. So if I'm sending gravitons from one place to another, then it will be ticks and clicks of that as well, if that's the case. So it will be the ticks and clicks of whatever quantum mechanical stuff is there. Okay? Good. All right. Great. So now there are two... Oh, by the way, I should mention that this result, what I described here, is actually, ironically, was first published in Scientific American, which I know you're not supposed to do. But it was in a science article. The actual derivation was published in a science article, a recent science article with Lorenzo Maccone and Vittorio Giovannetti in their limits of measurement issue in November. But it happened that the Scientific American article came out before that. So don't tell people Scientific American. I don't think they'll like it. So there are two fundamental limits to measurement. There are more, actually. quantum limits to measurement. But there's two that we'll use here that will pretty much boil it down to one. The first one is, well, no. I'll talk about measuring time here first. Well, let's talk about measuring things like space. So, for instance, there's the space momentum, distance momentum, Heisenberg uncertainty relationship, which simply says if I have some quantum mechanical system like a particle, but I cannot define its both its position as momentum to another certain degree of accuracy. This, by the way, leads to something that is called the standard quantum limit, which is frequently used in talking about things, for instance, gravitational wave detectors like Weber bars and stuff like that. The standard quantum limit, you say, oh, I can measure something to a particular accuracy, delta x, at some point. It has some spread in momentum. So because of the spread in momentum, if I know it at this point, then these wave packets spread out at a rate delta p, right? So the standard quantum limit says, oh, this wave packet spreads out at this rate, and so if you measure to a certain accuracy, then you can't measure it to the same accuracy later. You're going to measure to lesser accuracy later. Let me just say a few words about this, and then not talk about the standard quantum limit again. The standard quantum limit is standard, because it's very obvious in some sense. It's quantum, clearly, but it is not a limit. Okay, this is not true. This is only true for Gaussian wave packets. Okay, and in particular, you can easily see that it's not true because if I were to time reverse this wave packet, which is actually Gaussian but it's got funny phase information in it, it would go back to a smaller wave packet. All right. So you can certainly design wave packets whose dispersion decreases over time. So one must be very careful. Very careful. Care must be taken. Take care. That's all I have to say about the standard quantum limit. Standard quantum, so not a limit. I mean, it's a limit to how much you can measure this and this, but you've got to be careful about this one right here. Okay? And for a friend of
assuming three particle
Hamiltonian or something? Yeah, so if I just assume a particle evades a Schrödinger, this comes from a particle evades a Schrödinger equation. It's basically, you know, a simple hand-painting argument.
No, I mean,
Harmonic oscillator doesn't, the dispersion remains constant. Okay, but now there's some other limits which are actually quite useful. So more Heisenberg. So let's look at the energy-time Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Delta E, delta T is greater than or equal to H bar over 2. Okay? Now, this for a long time was misinterpreted, okay? People thought, oh, what does this mean? If I want to measure the energy of a system to an accuracy delta E, it takes an amount of time delta T greater than or equal to H bar over 2 delta E. Right? That's what people are doing. This is wrong. Okay? We're talking about wrong things. It's always fun to talk about mistakes other people have made, and then you go make your own mistakes, right? Okay. This does not mean that. In fact, Aharonov and Bohm back in the early 1960s, 1961 or 62, pointed out that this is not the case. And it's easy to construct measurement apparatuses which actually measure energy to an accuracy greater than this much faster than you'd expect. But what this does mean, all right? So everybody happy with that? What it does mean, here is a correct interpretation of this uncertainty principle. A correct, not the only one, but a correct interpretation is that if delta T is the time it takes for a clock to tick, a detector to click, or for that matter, a bit to flip, okay, so the time it takes for an elementary event, for something to happen, for a quantum system to go from one state to an orthogonal state, then the spread in energy of that state must be obeyed this. So delta E has to be greater than or equal to h bar over 2 delta t. So the faster it ticks or clicks, the higher the spread in energy. And I'll give some examples of this in just a second. Okay, that is a correct interpretation of this.
You mean the difference in energy of the eigenstates?
The spread, or the standard deviation, the standard deviation of the energy of the eigenstates on that state. So you want me to define it? Oh, fine, okay. Delta E is equal to the square root of the expectation value on the state. It could be a K density matrix as well, of H squared psi minus psi H psi squared all over 1/2 psi. Happy now? Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely agree with everything you said, but just want to throw in a little comment that was from Maharano.
Yeah, excellent.
They considered the system that they were measuring was a free particle.
Right.
And they neglected relativistic effects. It turns out that if you put them in, this thing comes back in a limit of time velocity.
Cool. That's very interesting. That's really interesting. But well, so let me mention something about this. The way that you get around this in general, the way that Maharano mode for this, if you want to derive measuring devices that violate this, what you do is you make, clearly, these are measuring, the detector is a measuring device, right? And so it takes some time to make the measurement. But you have to make the measurement apparatus have a high strain energy, so it goes fast. But the system can be slow, right? But that's a really important good point, and I didn't know that. That's really cool. Yeah?
Maybe just, I pretty agree with what you say, but it's not so precise when you say for the clock, delta t is the time for a clock to tick. So okay. Let me just put it this way, it's the time that any observable takes to move its expectation value by standard deviation.
No. Time for, no, wait, let's make this precise. Time for psi, some state with a state psi, to go to another state that is perpendicular to psi.
It could just be a state which has significant nonlinear.
Yeah. But it doesn't have to be perpendicular. Right. So that has low overlap. Almost that has small overlap with the original state. So to go from one state to an orthogonal or almost orthogonal state.
That's the same as saying
whatever. Yeah, I think, no, in the case, but that this is what you said didn't make sense for a qubit, right? So if I had a complete system, right. Which, that is indeed what true for a free particle. Right, so we're in agreement. This is great. I've never had so much agreement. I'm really worried about the latter parts of this talk.
Yeah. If you have two states in the definition of delta t, but only one state in the definition of delta t.
Because delta e is an invariant under Hamiltonian time evolution. Right? It commutes with the Hamiltonian. H squared commutes with the Hamiltonian, H commutes with the Hamiltonian. So if I have one state, if I look at the spread of energy of a state now, and I look at the spread of energy of the same state later on, it's the same. Okay? All right. Great. Excellent. Okay, now, this is very well known. This is Heisenberg. But now let me actually get another one, which is actually derived in the context of physics of computation. This was derived to talk about how hard does it perform quantum computation, how fast does it take to flip a bit. There is another limit, which is called the Margolis-Levitin theorem. After Norm Margolis and Lev Levitin, who invented it, Norm Margolis was a pioneer of physics of computation, both classical and quantum mechanical. Lev Levitin was a pioneer in the physics of communication. Norm is at MIT and Lev is at BU. This looks so close to the other one that it's almost indistinguishable. Oh, sorry. You know, I left out pi here. Let's get this right here. Let me get this correct. So pi h bar over 2. It's actually h over 4. I didn't. My notes are locked in my office, and my key won't open it up. So I'm good. Good. What are those? Okay, and I'll put this pi over here as well. This is kind of approximate greater than h bar. Okay, we're here.
Sorry, you just love me. Why on earth do you need a pi there?
I don't need a pi here. I don't need a 2 there either.
I think it's actually wrong with the pi.
Yeah, I think that made it right. Yeah. Thank you.
You already said you agree.
No. I don't
know how I am. I don't know. He agreed until I put the pi in there.
And you want the half there.
Yeah, I don't have it. Great. I'm actually just for audience. Okay, so what is E? E is equal to the expectation value of the energy, so like psi h, which I could also do with the density matrix right here, minus E naught, where this is the energy of the ground state. So the energy of the ground state of the system, if like, for instance, a harmonic oscillator has a zero-point energy, right? So the Margolis-Levitin theorem is proved by rather similar methods to what is actually really, this right here, this Heisenberg uncertainty principle was really proved by Fourier, right? Because if you just take E is equal to h bar omega, it just says that delta omega delta t is greater than pi h bar over 2, which was, you know, that has been known since Fourier. That's called Cauchy pitfall, right? So, anyway, so, but then we will prove it for Heisenberg here because of the h bar. All right. Now, this Margolis-Levitin theorem is less well known. Who here actually has heard prior to this talk of the Margolis-Levitin theorem? Yeah. Right. Not many people here, right? Right. But this, I claim that this is going to be more useful for us. Okay. This is going to be more useful. Delta t, by the way, of course, is exactly the same interpretation. It's the time for clock to tick, detector to click, bit to flip, or psi to go to something almost orthogonal to psi.
But from what to what? From the ground state to psi?
No, from one state to another state. So if I take this state psi, and I look at the process where it goes from psi to psi almost orthogonal, and then I take h, expectation value of h minus the ground state on this, then it's bounded in this case. Then
it's just the psi minus something orthogonal.
Psi something orthogonal, anything orthogonal. It doesn't have to work like this, right? If I start in the ground state, then I stay in the ground state. I don't go to anyone. It takes forever to go to orthogonal state. Which actually basis because E is zero.
Okay. What happens if you start in a constant energy state?
Then nothing happens as well.
Okay.
Energy eigenstates don't do anything, right?
E is still non-zero in that case, so don't.
Right. So this is an upper limit, right? It's still a basis. It's just failing to use the energy it has to flip. Right. It's greater than or equal to this. Right. There t equals infinity again if I'm an energy eigenstate. Okay, so this I claim is more useful for what I'm going to do if we're analyzing this kind of system than these Heisenberg principles. Heisenberg principles lead you to things like the standard quantum limit. Now the problem is that calculating these spreads in operator values, spreads in energy, okay, that is hard. And in particular, when I add up, when I take a whole bunch of systems together, like I take a whole bunch of clocks or a whole bunch of photons. What happens to the spread in energy depends on whether these are correlated or not. So if they're uncorrelated, the central limit theorem tells me the spread goes at the square root of the number of systems. But if they're correlated, then all bets are off. So it's actually rather hard to use this. Whereas in this case, the energy of a bunch of systems adds up modulo interactions between the systems. Okay? So we'll find this very useful for this. And let me give an example. A very familiar example, I'll use it to segue into the next bit, but I better speed up here. So the example is just a nuclear spin, or any two-level system, so any qubit, really. So in the state spin up, it has energy, the energy is equal to zero. In the state spin down, we put in a big Hawking magnetic field. In the state down, the energy is equal to 2 mu v, and I'll call this h bar omega. Okay? And this would be, I'm using nuclear spin to be true of a two-level atom or any other two-level system. I start this spin off in the state 1 over root 2 up plus down. Excuse me, didn't draw it very well. Up plus down. And over time, this goes to 1 over root 2 from the state up plus e to the minus I. omega t times c. Yeah. Right? Everybody happy with this? This is what happens. So, after a time, t is equal to, sorry, delta t, let me put delta t here. I'll call it delta t. When delta t is equal to pi over h bar, pi over omega, which is equal to pi h bar pi over e, then this is an orthogonal state. This is equal to 1 over root 2 minus down, right? So this state right here is spin in the x direction, and this state right here is spin in the y direction. The spin is actually undergoing Larmor precession, and it's processing around like this, and this is how long it takes. Okay?
It's in the minus x.
I'm sorry? What did you say?
In the minus x direction. X plus x to minus x.
Plus x to minus x, yes. So did I say y? Yeah, oh sorry, my fault. Yeah, so it goes from the plus x to the minus x direction, it goes to an orthogonal state.
Is there a half on that finally?
Yeah.
Where?
Well, I, the, what you wrote on this board has now a half, like the previous one.
But hold it. I didn't set up Daniel to say that. He said that it was wrong free will. Okay? So what is the average entropy about the ground state? The average entropy of the ground state is, well, it's 1 half 0 plus 1 half times E. Right? And what is the spread of energy? The spread of energy, well, there are two states. They're each equally spaced by E over 2 from the actual state. So the spread energy is E over 2. So delta T is equal to pi H bar pi L. These are the expectation value of E over 2. Pi H over 2, expectation value of E. And it's also equal to H bar pi times over 2 delta E. So it obeys both the Marbodo's Levitin theorem and it obeys the Heisenberg theorem. It saturates this. So a quantum spin that is precessing, undergoing Larmor precession, or a qubit that is flipping, or a two level system that's moving from one state to another, actually moves from one state to an orthogonal state exactly as fast as it's allowed to do, given the laws of quantum mechanics. So this is, you may have read somewhere that quantum computers, for instance, saturate the bounds of physics in terms of how fast you flip a bit. This, which is true even if you're like flipping bits in an MR at a rate of, you know, one flip every, you know, 1/1000th of a second or something like that. So they're doing it as fast as they can given the energy that you're applying. Alright?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If you're playing evolution delta P for size of like that, is that always going to be unitary?
But I'm assuming, well, this is true if it's a non-unitary evolution as well. But you have to, if it's a non-unitary evolution, that means your system is part of a larger system, and then you have to look at the spread and energy of the larger system. Right. So the way to get around that is the usual way in quantum mechanics of saying, oh, I have an open system, non-unitary time evolution, I embed it in the larger system where the evolution is unitary. Yeah. So yeah, these are theorems, right? And this is an example to show you why they work. Or that they do work in a particularly simple case.
Can you explain a little bit more how you can go from a bit flip like this to making a statement about how long it takes for a detector to play?
Well, so this is true of when a detector clicks, right? It goes from a state where it hasn't clicked to an orthogonal state, to a state where it has clicked. That other state is orthogonal, because you have to distinguish between the two states. So when a detector moves to a state where it says something has happened, right, it has to move from its initial state to an orthogonal state. So all that's happening here is that this applies to any process where a system goes from one state to an almost orthogonal state.
Okay. I guess I'm worried about the issue of producing an irreversible.
Irreversible, yeah.
That's sort of issue that
yeah.
might
I understand.
Come with its own time scale, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm not going to worry about any kind of fundamental irreversibility here. Okay, so in what I'm going to talk about here, or rather, I do worry about that sort of things, and you're right to worry about that, but I'm not going to discuss it here. It's a good question, but it doesn't make any difference in terms of how fast it gets there. Question of whether it's reversible or not is another question. Which I'll leave for another time if that's okay. We can talk, ask me again after we're done. Okay, so that's the end of the basic review of these very, very simple ideas about quantum measurement. Are there questions about this? Everybody happy with it? Yeah?
Exactly, question, but, well, that's the leaving aside pi or something like that. Doesn't the second theorem follow almost trivially from the first one?
No, not quite. No. It's not quite the same as the proof of the Cauchy theorem. I urge you to check out this proof. It's because, I mean, it's quite different, really. I mean, they look almost exactly the same, but remember this, the second theorem comes with a state where you have a ground state of the energy.
Right.
And these need not both apply. Right. So, for instance, you can easily construct systems where the speed. If you look at the speed it takes for a system to go from. Oh, sorry. They need not both be saturated.
No.
So whichever is worst is the one that gets obeyed. Right. So if the Margolis-Levitin theorem tells you to do something fast, but Heisenberg tells you you have to do it more slowly, then you have to do it more slowly. I'm not talking.
No, I was just thinking that if. You have to have at least a dispersion of delta D, then you have to be at least delta D above the ground state.
Oh, not necessarily, right?
Just roughly. That's
no, roughly, 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 right. Roughly, true.
So you can think of relative distance factor of time, maybe.
No.
No.
So if I have, for instance, I can have an infinite standard deviation. Very easy to construct into an infinite standard deviation, but it's a finite value, average value.
Yes, that's true.
Right? So you certainly, if I have take half a galaxy, this will be true. But yeah, roughly speaking, they're clearly related, right? But it's not obvious how they're related. Roughly speaking, they look similar. Okay, yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah,
and if you event, you know, you define the event as the way the sign coming perpendicular to itself.
Yeah.
What are the quantum non-Newtonian experiments?
I'm sorry. But the measurement apparatus becomes perpendicular to its previous state, making the state alone. But the measurement apparatus moves from one state to an orthogonal state. You have to apply this to both the system and the apparatus. So I'm thinking when something happens, I'm identifying an event that the system went from one state to an orthogonal state,
basically.
I'm sorry?
By the system, you put the apparatus.
Yeah, you got it. You have to write, so you have to include the apparatus. If I use this to describe an apparatus and say how long does it take to detect the clip, I have to apply quantum mechanics to the apparatus itself. The apparatus is a quantum mechanical system. Okay, so now let's turn to atomic clocks. So that was one, I guess. That's zero. This is one. This is two. Hold on, one, because then the board goes on. So let's look at clocks. Well, atomic clocks actually are just a bunch of spins, right? There are cesium atomic clocks, or are just, you just use hyperfine levels inside of cesium, and you're in fact just looking at nuclear spins inside of the cesium. And so an atomic clock works exactly in this way. I mean, actually, it's kind of fun the way it works. You take a spin, it spin up, you take it and you put it so it spins sideways, it starts to process. You use a local oscillator to do it. So the clock itself is actually not the spin or the cesium atom, or the collection of the cesium atoms that we're doing. The clock is actually an oscillator, and the oscillator is oscillating up and down, and you count the number of times it oscillates. It's a big, huge, honking, semi-classical thing. All right? You use this oscillator to pop this down, and this goes at a frequency omega, and this goes at frequency omega naught. And omega is approximately equal to omega naught. You want it to go at the same frequency as the cesium atom. And then you let it process and process and process, and when you think it's after some time, it goes around and around and around. And after you think it should be back where it is now, you rotate it back. And then you check, is it up or is it down? Now, if this stays in phase, if your oscillator stays in phase with the spin, then it will be exactly there when you rotate it back. It will be up with 100% probability. But if it's out of phase, right, so it's over here, when you rotate it back up, there's some amplitude where you find it's down. So you made a mistake, and then you know that you're out of sync. Okay? This is the way, are there any atomic, I'm not an expert on atomic clocks, so I gave a talk at NIST, it was very scary. Any experts on atomic clocks here to correct me if my very superficial picture of it? I think it's nice to know it's a feedback loop between a semi-classical oscillator, which counts the number of oscillations, and these cesium atoms or rubidium atoms, whatever you want to use, that are supposed to be all exactly identical. Okay? So clearly for this, the accuracy, goes as, goes basically as delta t, or delta capital delta t, goes as roughly 1 over omega, something like that. And if I have n spins, or n atoms, then the accuracy delta t n, we'll call delta t n classical for reasons that we'll see in just a moment, goes as 1 over square root of n omega. Okay, so I'm ignoring factors of pi and stuff like that here. This is like a third of number four. I want to be careful. I'm just going to solve that problem by not putting them in. So this is just from the central limit theorem, right? If I have n of these spins, I'm trying to measure where they are in this plane. If they're n of them and they're uncorrelated with each other, then I get these to an accuracy goes as 1 over the square root of n. So the accuracy scales as the number of spins. Of course, the actual limit to an ordinary quantum clock, and maybe current standards are these fountain atomic clocks, where you take the fountain CC atoms, and you take them up, and then you do this while they're up in the air.
The accuracies of those are not limited so much by the number of spins, but things by like local magnetic field homogeneities and stuff like that. And but this is kind of the fundamental limit of this. And let me point out that it's actually possible to do better. Oh, and so why is this? This really comes from Heisenberg. This is from Heisenberg, because if I take the spread of energy of n spins, it's square root of n times the spread of energy of one spin if they're uncorrelated. Right? So this accuracy right here is obeying this Heisenberg limit here. And it's not the Margolis-Levitin theorem says, oh, maybe I could do it faster. Right? Because the actual energy is scaling as n times the number of spins. But here, the Heisenberg limit kicks in because of the central limit theorem. So you might ask, well, could you do better? And the answer is yes. And it was pointed out quite a long time ago, basically 10 years ago or more, by Dave Wineland. And this, indeed, this was Dave Wineland's actual motivation for getting in to the quantum computing business, to build ion traps. Because what he pointed out is, suppose I have n entangled spins. Rather than this state, so rather than this, the state of just n unentangled spins, so that is a state that's just like this, right? They're all pointing in this direction, so that process around. And that's equal to 1 over root 2 times up plus down. That's 1 over root 2. I'm not going to put the direct brackets in there, that's okay for you. What's down? So 1 over root 2. What's down? Okay. Suppose we actually have an entangled state. And these are actually called cat states, because they're like Schrodinger cat states. So I don't see any point in quantum really into the Schrodinger cats. They're just an entangled state of the atoms. 1 over root 2, up, 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 plus down, down, down. Okay? Suppose you have this state. Now, what does this state do over time? Over time, it goes, well, these are in the ground state, and these are in the excited state, and these acquire a phase, e to the minus n omega t. Right? So you see that this cat state actually behaves, behaves like a two-level system, but a two-level system whose energy is n times the energy of the original system. Okay? And what we find here is that E, so then, is equal to n times the energy for one system, and delta E, now very important, delta E n is equal to n times the spread of energy for one system, because you can see the spread of energy of the system is as big as it could possibly be. Right? This is the state that has the largest spread in energy. And what the Heisenberg principle exhorts us to do is that if we want things to happen fast, we want to create states that have high spread in energy. Now, you see right here that the accuracy delta T m q that I get from this. This is like just having, instead of having n atoms whose fluctuations average out according to the central limit theorem, it's like having one super atom whose frequency is n times the original one. And this is delta TQn is equal to 1 over n omega. This is 1 over n omega. Right? So you get a square root of n enhancement in accuracy. Okay? So, okay, good. Everybody happy with this? Great. Amazing. I like most people happy. People look very happy, but they're unhappy, so.
Well, one can be a little unhappy because it's unstable.
Yeah.
Because of the slightest little perturbation going to mess you up.
Absolutely. And in fact, it was pointed out later by folks at Oxford that of course, that this state tends to apply a correlated noise on these spins, it will dephase m times as fast. Well, absolutely. But of course, there's nothing to really do about that, because in fact, if you make something that is square root of n times sensitive, then to, you know, time, right, in measuring time, it is by definition will be square root of n more sensitive to anything that messes up the measurement of time. So yeah, you can be a little unhappy about it. And indeed, that's I think why they don't want necessarily to do this. Then atomic clocks are not, most accurate atomic clocks are not built this way. Perhaps I'm likely to assume.
So how important is your argument that it's n and that's where we're going?
Well, so it's important because what I want to get back to this point right here, I will just want to point out to you that it is in fact, you know, it is in principle possible to construct systems that reach this saturate both as Margolis, Levitin, and as Heisenberg limit. But you may have to do, you know, a resort to funky quantum weirdness to make it happen. Okay.
And then you can start to be refined and introduce correlation lengths into the macroscopic system and say that that's okay within a correlation length. And
It's not so great. It's not so bad. Right. And you can also, you can adjust these states to make states that are not quite as sensitive in terms of measuring time, but also less sensitive to noise. Right. So, okay. Let me actually look at time of arrival measurements, because this is actually work that I did together with Lorenzo Vittorio. We basically did the same thing for time of arrival measurements for photons. Okay, so if I have one photon, so a single photon, it looks a little trickier and involves quantum electrodynamics, or what I call non-relativistic quantum electrodynamics, whatever that means. It means that the energy to the energy is smaller than the mass of the electron. Okay, so one photon in a state phi, and the photon in the state, what is it called? Now, okay. So it's the integral of a wave function of here. I'll write this like this. So this is a state where there is one photon in the mode labeled by frequency omega, and no photons in the other modes. Right, it's slightly trickier than the other case. So when you have n photons, n uncorrelated, okay, so phi in the state phi, we find once again that delta E, so n goes as square root of n delta E. By making these photons uncorrelated, then this we get the square root of n here from the Heisenberg, and so from the central limit theorem. And so when we apply the Heisenberg limit to these things, we find, once again, that our accuracy scales as 1 over square root of n, which is called the shot noise limit. One of the lessons of this talk is that, remember the standard quantum limit? It was standard in quantum, but not a limit. What do you think about the shot noise limit? Well-known limit. Do you think it's a limit? No, of course not. Why would I be bringing this up for rhetorical reasons? We're not actually a limit. But if I take an entangled, time of arrival, delta t of arrival, goes as 1 over square root of n. If I take n entangled photons, okay, so now here's this kind of funky state there, frequency entangled. So I take n, this is the first photon, here's the second photon. So these are different, if you like, different spatial modes. And this is a state, this is a state in which if I measure the frequency of the first photon, then all the other photons will turn out to have that frequency. Okay, so it's highly entangled in terms of frequency. It's the analog of this state up over here. Oh my God, I have this terrible habit to leave these basics up here. Now, if I look at this, it doesn't take a lot of squinting at this state, or it might take a lot of squinting, but to note that this state also has the feature that, so the energy of the state is equal to n times the energy of the single photon state, but the spread in energy now of this state is equal to n times the spread in energy of a single photon state. And so delta t for arrival q, I should call this one classical, goes as 1 over n. So it beats the shot noise slower. Okay? Everybody happy with this? All right. So basically what I've shown you, yeah.
Did they know that at LIGO?
They didn't know this. Because
I think they worked with that.
Yeah, so the LIGO, they actually, so a LIGO, by the way, this is a time arrival measurement, and LIGO is an interferometer. It's actually, I should mention, that the square root, the first square root of an enhancement of the sort to be analyzed thoroughly was for interferometry. And they figured if you use n entangled photons, you could improve the limit of interferometry and have it go as 1 over n instead of 1 over square root of n. And they did, I think, consider that. The problem is that, you know, you can make, if you're doing things with classical light, you can make n huge. And actually in LIGO, it is huge, right? I mean, it's scary how much power is in those beams in LIGO. That's one of their biggest problems. But it's very hard to make n, you know, megawatt of entangled, sorry, watts of entangled photons. Yeah.
If you're using photons using squeeze states and stuff like that, then it also help?
Yeah, so squeeze states, this is also, we also showed that you could use squeeze states and get a similar kind of effect.
Okay.
This is basically, you can think of this as anti-squeezing in energy, right? So if you take a single photon that's squeezed in anti-squeezed in energy,
mm-hmm.
then you can get a similar effect.
Wasn't squeezing initially invented just for the purpose of improving interferometry?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah. Hey, this is a colloquium, right? I'm telling you the way. This is known stuff, right? So the wacky quantum stuff is less well known, but yeah. So right. I mean, it all fits together. I guess is how I say. Yeah. Okay. So this is basically a summary of the. First part of the science paper about analyzing measurements, how accurate we can measure things. So if you use, basically the message here, if you use funky quantum effects, funky quantum states, then you can actually get measurement devices that actually saturate both the Heisenberg and the Margolis-Levitin limit, and you can get it so that, you know, so that your temporal resolution scales as the energy in the problem rather than the square root of the energy. So that's good. Okay, any questions about this? Good. So now let's go on to gravity and let's do some fun stuff with gravity. I'm gonna actually just rewrite this down here. Delta T Q, so n goes as 1 over n, and then I'll erase this. So what does this all say? Well, if I want to measure time to a greater degree of accuracy, I need to have more energy, right? That's basically what it says. It takes energy to do so. The more energy, you know, to move things from one state to another, the more energy you have, the faster you can move from one state to another. In this picture right here, if I want to get a greater spatial-temporal resolution of measuring the geometry of space-time in this GPS, I want clocks that tick faster, right? And detectors that click faster. And signals that are more energetic. Okay? Now, here's the problem. So, greater accuracy in measuring time, greater accuracy implies more energy. We need more energy. So, I take my set of GPS satellites, and I start to give them more and more and more and more energy. They tick faster. They're like, I can crowd them closer together if I want. I'm starting really to, you know, kick some serious geometry butt in terms of, in fact, I noticed on the, it says in Greek on the way into this building that no person ignorant of geometry entered here, right? Which is kind of ironic since, you know, Plato, on whose academy that was originally described, really didn't know much geometry. Anyway, and I certainly didn't know about this kind of geometry. Okay, so I can put in more energy. The clocks are ticking faster. The signals are humming along. What's the problem? What's the problem here? What happens if I keep on doing this? If I go too far, I'm cramming more and more energy into this spatial volume. Right. It becomes a black hole. Too much energy. Right. Implies a black hole. Okay, that's bad, right? Because if some part of your GPS network becomes a black hole, it's really not very good, very useful for you in terms of measuring space-time geometry. It may go happily on measuring space-time geometry in the black hole itself until, you know, smushes into the singularity, But so far as you're concerned on the outside, it's pretty useless, right? So in general, you want to make sure that the mass that you have, well, so I think of the Schwarzschild radius is related to the mass by R is equal to 2gm over c squared. That's a Schwarzschild radius. So I want to make sure that the mass within this is less than or equal to c squared over 2, sorry, c squared rs over 2g. In our picture right there, we have x was the circumference of the spatial region. So by the way, the argument I'm making here is basically at the same level of Bekenstein's argument for a lot of things, all right? So let's assume that things are spherically roughly symmetric for what I'm describing here. That's equal to c squared x over 4g. And I want to have the energy, which is equal to E is equal to mc squared. It's always very fun if you could actually find, for this being the year of Einstein, right? To have a legitimate excuse to write down E equals mc squared on the board. So that has to be equal to less than x c to the fourth over 4g. All right? Okay. So we're making some progress here. Now we know that there's a limit to how much energy we can cram into this subvolume of spacetime in order to measure it. And because of this, we can actually now count the total number of ticks and clicks that can go on there. So we'll be able to get a formula for this resolution. So the number of ticks plus clicks is less than or equal to t times the rate of ticking and clicking. So the rate of ticking and clicking is 2e over pi h bar, right? So this is the number of ticks and clicks per second, right? By the maximum number by the Margolis-Levitt theorem. So which in turn is less than or equal to t times t over pi h bar times x. So excuse me, 2 times x over 4. So I don't have my notes, so I can't remember exactly where all the things come out. And so this is just equal to 1 over 2 pi x times t over h bar g c to the fourth, which is equal to 1 over 2 pi times x over the Planck length times t over the Planck time. Okay? And this is what, so this is what I call the quantum geometric limit. So it's a limit to the number of elementary events. So the number is less than or equal to this.
But aren't things going to go haywire way before that?
Yeah.
Sure. Because of the interaction among all the photons when you really get.
Oh yeah, you're cramming, it's very energetic. Well, I mean, yeah, the fact that
there's going to be a tremendous amount of gravitational interaction in a photon like that.
But that's okay. I mean, I think it's okay. Yeah, it's okay if my GPS clocks interact with each other gravitationally, right? They still map out spacetime, but they're going to map out spacetime together with the effects of all these GPS clocks in spacetime. So if the clocks are as big as galaxies, right, which is perfectly okay, then when I look at when these signals arrive, they will take into account the effect of those clocks on the spacetime. So that's actually a very good point. But it doesn't mess it up. It just makes it more interesting. It makes it a lot harder to calculate, too, right? So I haven't talked at all about the backing out of the geometry of space-time is from this Einstein procedure. I'm just, you know, saying, okay, we can in principle back this up if we know when these signals left and arrived. But yeah, that's a very good point. But I would claim that it's okay for these things to be gravitating. You still map out space-time.
But is that some of these, especially the entangled tricks, use superpositions of different quantum states. Gravity comes in naturally to superpositions, so to speak, of different metrics.
That is a really great point. Yeah. So my claim, and this goes to this theory of gravity based on quantum computation, is that a fluctuation in space-time geometry, know, a quantum fluctuation in space-time geometry is indistinguishable from a quantum fluctuation in the device that you use to measure it, right? If these devices exhibit these quantum fluctuations, right? Sorry. Yeah. So this is great. So this is I'm setting this up there for people to shoot it down if they feel like it, right? A fluctuation in space-time geometry, so a quantum fluctuation in space-time geometry, is indistinguishable from a quantum fluctuation in the device you use to measure that space-time geometry. So for instance, my clocks have, you know, there are quantum fluctuations in how accurately they measure time. And in some component of the superposition, they say the time was this. And another component of the superposition, they say the time was that. Well, that's equivalent to saying, in one component of the superposition, the geometry was this. And another component of the superposition, the geometry was that. So you could say that you can't really, it's as if when you measure these space-time geometries, you have actually fluctuations in the space-time geometry. And I can claim, and my claim is, this comes similarly, so to say, well, let's try to think how you could distinguish this. There's no way to distinguish such a fluctuation in your measurement of space-time geometry from an actual fluctuation in space-time geometry. Because how would you do it? You have to measure it. Okay. Yeah.
In your scheme of things, is this an assumption or an outcome?
No, that was just simply a declaration of personal taste. that was an editorial statement. Well, I take it very seriously as an editorial statement. Yeah.
Yes. Going back to your formula there, I guess I'm a bit surprised to see that you have a two-dimensional measure of volume.
Yeah. Isn't this interesting? So let me just talk a little bit. Let's leave the philosophy just a second.
And let's come back to you. You have to qualify. One example I know is in black holes, in black hole evaporation.
Right.
Example, if you can have the Hawking ideal calculation of free field theory, that gets completely messed up when you take into account quantum fluctuations of the radiation field in the vicinity of the horizon.
Sure.
And you're going to swallow the photons, and there's nothing going to be left. It's nothing like what you say.
Well, no, I agree. So remember,
The quantum fluctuations are just, you can't keep track. We don't know anything.
Right. So I think that's consistent with what I said.
Because I thought that at the level, there are two scales. One is the horizon scale itself, and the other is the distance from the horizon.
Yeah.
And you have to keep these two scales apart, because even quite far from the horizon, you can get messed up.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's a... Because the fluctuations, the quantum fluctuations of, say, ingoing modes, and mess up completely the description of the outgoing modes that you're going to measure.
Yeah.
And so.
This is right. So I agree with that. I actually agree. You know, things get really messed up in these situations. Remember, I'm calculating upper bounds to how much accuracy you could get. If things get messed up, you might do far worse.
But the upper bound might not be worth very much.
No. The upper bound, this is a hard and fast upper bound. Excuse me, I have to argue.
The upper bound might be, but...
Actual amount is much worse. You might have many, many fewer bits of information, and a much lower number of accuracy. Right. Good. So I think we're on the same page on this. Let me just, since I'm running out of time due to the enthusiastic and excellent audience participation, let me actually say a few more things about this. Just explore this a little bit, including the place of black holes, to say what it, see what it says, and then let's go wild on all this other stuff, right? All right. Okay. So let me just say what this is like. This is like, let's take you. If I wanted to make this more precise, okay, to make this non-spherical, this is like, I think, a world sheet, a two-dimensional world sheet, or a one plus one-dimensional world sheet that goes through this region right here, and I measure it off in Planck units, right? It's like I take a string world sheet. Oh, I maybe shouldn't say that. But it's a bit like that, right? So I take a string world sheet that goes through it, I measure it off in Planck units, and it says, I can't have more than the area of this world sheet in Planck step because it's the number of bits. It's a bit, now I explain this is a bit like holography, right? You can imagine all these ops, all these ticks and clicks that take place in this volume being projected onto this two-dimensional sheet. And then we say, oh, we can't have a density greater than a Planck. This is, remember the argument of holography, which limits the number of bits in a spatial volume, a free volume, in terms of the area of the free volume. At first argued, we can imagine those bits being projected onto the boundary of this volume. We can have a density of bits that's greater than, you know, one of the Planck lengths right there. Yeah.
Well, something bothers me about that formula a little bit, because it suggests that if I wanted to have a very large volume, I would be able, in principle, to measure things much shorter than a Planck time, and vice versa, right? It's the product that has to be greater than something. So if I wanted T to be much less than TP, I could get away with it if I had a giant X. And that sort of runs against the grain.
Okay. T as much as the TP.
But that concerns Hawking's first order phase transition. Yeah. If the volume becomes big enough, then
I think that's not a very good situation, right? Because you're saying is X is really, really big. Okay. And then my volume looks like this. So T is really, really small. Right, X is big, and T is really, really small. Yeah, well, let me just say that if you you might be able, I'm not claiming you can saturate this power. All right, let me just put it that way. So I'm not claiming you can saturate this power. So maybe there's something. It seems this is a little funny situation, right? Because your quanta are going to be spread out through all of this, and they don't have any. They don't have time to talk. One side of this volume doesn't have time to talk with the other part of the volume.
So that's what I mean. There's other considerations that should come into play.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying
to say. Yeah, yeah. So what you say doesn't invalidate this. It simply says it may not be able to be saturated in certain cases. Right? So let me just actually give some examples here. Okay. So, because
Maybe as part of it, you can explain why this whole thing should be covariant if it's not so isometric.
Yeah, yeah. My attempt to make this covariant, okay? Let's try to make this covariant. Maybe I should. Can I do this example so then I try to make it covariant? Is that all right? Okay. So examples. Well, the first example is a very simple one. It's like when you said that we don't make this weird, we just make it, you know, here is XP and here is TP, and it says you can have one tick in a Planck scale. And this is very familiar, right? Because it says if I try to take a quantum, a single quantum, and I take it down, I try to make it shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter wavelength. What is the Planck scale? It's a scale at which the de Broglie wavelength is equal to Schwarzschild radius, right? So I'm claiming that, so this says you can't, this is the maximum number of ticks and clicks in a Planck volume is one, okay, if they're the same size. So one tick. Okay? If you take, here's another example. Now, let me point out something here. You know, as you said, it's kind of funny that it's just X times T. What we're going to end up is much smaller numbers of ticks and clicks than you would think if you tend to believe, oh, we can have everything at the Planck scale, right? There you think scales the number, if you did a tick and click per Planck unit, you'd expect it to go as the fourth, you know, as the fourth power here, rather than just the square. If you take the universe itself, and so the universe itself, when we take X, is roughly equal to CT, and T is roughly equal to, you know, 10 to the 10th years, which is roughly 10 to the 17th seconds. Then we find that the, so, maybe I better do this up on this. Well, I'll do it right here. Then we find what we get is T squared over TP squared, which is on the order of 10 to the 120. So the universe itself, by the way, the universe itself, right, actually is very close to its critical density, which is a density where it would be a black hole. So in fact, it's got just the right amount of mass to try to saturate this bound. Okay? So what we find is that there are 10 to the 120 ticks and clicks in the universe as a whole. Now, if I take these events and I spread them out uniformly in space-time, up to this point. X is equal to CT.
Yeah.
T is equal to 10 to the 10th years.
Yeah.
So I have X, so I have CT right here. So I get CT over times T. So that's the square. That just becomes some Planck time. So I get T squared over the Planck time squared. Yeah, right. So now, of course, at the very early universe, the matter densities were higher. Stuff was happening faster. Right? It was closer together. But if I look at the average spacing, this means that the average spacing of an event, of between events in our universe, is, you know, something macroscopic, something like, you know, on the order of this size. And indeed, you know, that may sound bizarre, but it's not so bizarre. Because imagine, what's another way of thinking of this? What would the sort of the event size be? Well, first of all, space-time is called black body radiation. Black body radiation is what? How many centimeters is something like this? Right? Is it millimeters?
Tenth of a mile.
No, 3 degrees Kelvin black body radiation. It's like this, right. Yeah. So now if you imagine, if you take all the matter in the universe and turn it into black body radiation, okay? Then you'd actually get, you'd get something that was wavelengths that were maybe 100 or 1,000 times smaller, not that much smaller. And indeed, you can think of the black body radiation as mapping out the geometry of space-time out there in interstellar space. But it only maps out that geometry of space-time to an accuracy given, like, I saw back up there that the answer is this. 3 centimeters, something like that, right? Yeah. Okay. So, in fact, now if we compare this with holography, let me actually erase it.
There's a graviton background that's being shorter away. What's not, look, I mean, this is very ideal.
The graviton background should be.
I mean, a region where gravity is strong and you have an unrenormalizable theory, and it becomes manifest at this scale that you're talking about. So, how is it physically relevant?
Well, look, I mean, remember, I'm actually not claiming about. So as long as what happened here, why does this work? So what were the assumptions going to this being an upper limit? The assumption is that quantum mechanics is unitary. Okay?
Yeah, that's pretty good.
That's it. Yeah, no, okay, no, I understand. So it might actually be that it's not unitary.
Right.
Right? You say we'll see non-unitarity at scales of 7 meters?
No. I'm assuming the quantum mechanics is unitary, and that gives us this limit. I'm actually claiming, I would be very surprised if we saw. I would be surprised if we saw. I don't necessarily believe quantum mechanics is non unitary. It might be non unitary, but it might not be.
Okay,
we don't want to say quantum
mechanics. If you define quantum mechanics as a unitary theory, you have to scale them, of course, you're right, but it's a pathology.
Well, okay, so
because
the quantum mechanics has been tested.
Freedom of gravity, which we don't know how to do.
But however, quantum mechanics has been tested to be unitary in accelerator experiments at very high energy. So quantum mechanics is very unitary to the extent that we've actually tested.
But I mean, that issue about distance is just an average of the universe, right? I mean, most distances are a lot emptier because they're much closer together here on Earth.
Look, heck, we know the things, you know. I worked on an experiment with Norman Granzi to look at the electric dipole moment of the neutron where they measured a charge separation inside the neutron of 10 to the minus 25 centimeters, right? If you're willing to put in a lot of time and a lot of energy, you know, and bring it all together in one place, then you can actually measure things more accurately. And indeed, that's what's happening. Here on Earth, we measure things to much greater accuracy than this because we have more energy there.
But
there's no try to do it everywhere in the universe at once.
But you're still not a bright light.
No.
That doesn't matter.
No, of course not. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm confused about where these cat states entered into your calculation of the quantum geometric limit.
Oh.
You spent quite a lot of time on it. And the other thing which may be related to my confusion is this 2e over pi h bar. Can you explain again where that happened?
Oh, yeah, so remember that happened? Remember, so if you want to remember what it is, the limit is just imagine a spin processing from one to another.
In that calculation, though, why are you taking time and multiplying it by that? Are you assuming that you're in
so
a
this
state
is the,
or something?
This is the number of ops per second. So this is the total number of, so if I take, remember, if I invert this, it's the minimum amount of time it takes something to flip. So it takes amount of time it takes something to go from one state to another. So if I take 1 over that time, it's the rate at which information and bits are flipping. That's why that's there.
How did the entanglement enter into this?
So I argued that if this is an upper limit, but to attain this upper limit, you are very likely to have to use entanglement. And as is being pointed out correctly, you're unlikely to actually be able to attain this limit. But if everything goes right, and if things are unitary, and if you come up with the right states, then you might possibly get to this point in terms of determining the geometry of space-time. But you will most likely not be much worse off in terms of determining space-time geometry.
So without entanglement, you might find only one event for cubic meter or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Maybe the probably, yeah, maybe the black body radiation, which is, you know, bigger than the theoretical, but maybe that's doing as well as it can. Right? And probably, so the universe happens to be, have just the right energy to do the maximum, or something close to the right energy to do the maximum number of oxygen it can do. So maybe it's doing as best it can to measure its own geometry. So let me just compare, and I promise to try to make this coherent. Compare holography. So holography says, number of bits in the flea volume is less than or equal to area, the surface area around the flea volume divided by the Planck length square. And what we're saying is that the number of ops in a floor volume is less than or equal to the area. So let me try to get this right. So let me try to make this covariant. Take this, rather than having x times t, let's take an extremal world shape going through the volume. Okay, that area is this covariant. And it means that I don't have to use a extremal world sheet divided by the Planck time times the Planck length. And instead of E times T, energy times time is not covariant, so we should probably use instead number of ops is equal to those as the energy times the time. We should have it go something like, well, the obvious covariant thing is something like the trace of the energy momentum tensor over that volume. So some scalar that's associated with this. This is the, certainly if I take a bunch of massive, particles moving around, like a dust, a self-gravitating dust, then, so like these plots that I described, then the integral of t mu will be this thing that I calculated over there. So this then is covariant, and this is covariant also. But I do not have proof of this, right? This whole argument is that we kind of Bekenstein bound limit for talking about holography. Okay?
So it depends on the world sheet, you have to specify which, or...
Yeah, presumably, extremal, so now, so maybe people can help me with this. So I certainly want to extremize in time, so the maximal distance in terms of time, right, which would be, corresponds to, for a clock sitting in its rest train going through it. Now, but if I go in space, I take an extremal world sheet, and then I take the maximum area of an extremal world sheet. Would that do? I'm just speculating about this. He asked me to try to make a covariant. I'm just telling you my speculations about it.
I don't even get the underlying idea. This is the extremal world sheet contained in that value?
Yeah, so contained in that four volume. So,
No, because you could make the area out of those figures.
Oh, just by crinkling it up. Yeah, so maybe we have to, what's the proper way to do this? This is why I'm here in perimeter, to get people to help you with this kind of stuff. You guys don't know what this means.
Yeah, also ordinary, an organ field is, not covariant, and Busso came up with this light sheet.
So this might have to make it covariant, right? The number of ticks and clicks is a scalar quantity. That's a nice thing, right? I mean, it's just an integral, that's the total number of angles rotated by these systems. You know, the total number of angles of pi rotated by these systems in there. Everybody agrees on the number of ticks and clicks, so it is a scalar quantity. So the question is how to look at these areas in this way. I mean, I actually looked at these kind of Busso volumes, right? So they're where you take, expanding light cone and contracting light cone and ask the number of ticks and clicks in there. Now, I don't know the answer to that.
Is that true, actually, that everyone agrees? I mean, what if you have like a Riddler observer or something that could see extra particles?
No, that's true. It's still true because it's merely that when you have a Riddler observer, this accelerated observer receives extra particles. They still agree on when the state has moved from an orthogonal state to another state. There are extra particles there, but the state still moved from one state to an orthogonal state. But it's just a unitary transformation between the picture according to a Riddler observer and to another observer. So it's a scalar quantity.
Sorry, but if the Hertzfeld guy sees no particles at all.
Yeah, but so they disagree on the number of particles that are there, but they do agree on when a state goes from one state to an orthogonal state. Because they just have different pictures of the unitary time evolution, and the question of whether those, which are related, unitarily related to each other. And so when the state goes from one state to an orthogonal state is independent of their
They have different Hilbert spaces.
Yeah, well, because they have different notions of what the time is. But if they specify what their state is, right, and I specify a time slice, a Cauchy surface, right, and I say, here's a state on this Cauchy surface, and then I specify another Cauchy surface later on when it's gone for an orthogonal state, and then someone in a different reference frame calculates, did it go from one state to an orthogonal state, they will agree. So that's actually...
That's a different notion, correct, but if it's in a uniform set, accelerated observer, it has an arrive that you might have to trace over a part of space time. So that tracing over may truncate into the space, and then you get some but for one observer as unit time evolution may not be clear.
Right, but what I'm actually planning is, remember, so the even accelerated observer says, I say, oh, okay, here are my Cauchy surfaces, right? Sure. Let me draw something. So here's, well, let's draw it out so that we actually get this right. So I say, here are my Cauchy surfaces like this, and I define some state on these Cauchy surfaces, and I say, okay, it goes from this state to this other state.
And that's even, in the Cauchy space.
Yeah, right. So now even the Rindler observer, so here's my Rindler observer, his constant time surfaces go like, here's his horizon, he's accelerated like this, and his constant time surfaces go like this, right? So now I can, what he says, I'm doing field theory on my constant time surfaces. Then I say, oh, yeah, you're a Rindler observer. Here's what your field theory looks like. So he says, I had a state go from one state to an orthogonal state, from here on this Cauchy surface to here on this Cauchy surface. Then I would say, in order to verify what he said, I would say, okay, let me calculate what this looks like, and then let me calculate what happened here. And I would agree that he saw it go from this state to an orthogonal state. Right? You have to be careful about what it means for the system to go from a state to an orthogonal state in exactly this way.
But once more, you're getting very overly ideal, because if you wait a while, if you really look at the accelerated observer, and you don't do the mathematics, but do the physics,
right.
But then the accelerated observer approaches very quickly, arbitrarily close to the horizon that you set out initially, and he's too close, and he hugs the horizon so closely that your calculations are not being...
I'm not saying that this is... all I'm claiming is that if quantum mechanics, if quantum mechanics is unitary, then the number of ticks and clicks is a scalar quantity.
But it's not.
Because you come
exponentially close to the original horizon that you laid out very rapidly.
Well, with the
not the
is that you
well, yeah because
I mean as a result of
you wait and you can you rapidly your hyperbole rapidly approaches the speed of light and you hug the horizon,
right.
You're better than the Planck length very, very quickly. And then everything fails. You can't do field theory anymore.
But hold on, the Rindler observer sees in his or her regress frame, she sees a horizon at a constant distance, right? Equal to a rate, one over a rate of acceleration. So if I go to that frame, things should be okay.
If I'm in the Minkowski frame and I try to put myself in the shoes of the accelerated observer, I don't know how to do it after a while. I don't know what the transformation is to get so close. They're taking into account the very small length scale that I have to look to. I don't think that Lorentz invariance, as we use it in the naive way, is a correct concept anymore.
Okay, so let me just say, so I think we're actually agreeing in the sense that I'm saying, okay, as long as things are unitary, then this is Lorentz, this is a scalar quantity, you're saying the things are unitary, which is fine. I have nothing to. I'm not quite sure I understand your objection with the case of the Rindler observer. I understand that I'm hovering right next to a black hole about this problem, but somehow it doesn't seem to be the Rindler observer.
And when you say the Rindler observer, you mean what we say
about the Rindler
observer? In our frame, we imagine that there's a Rindler observer.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Okay. Is this a legitimate concept when the that imaginary Rindler observer it gets to within the Planck length of the horizon.
Okay. Yeah, so I can understand that might be some problems there. Yeah.
So, well, I've been studying a bit like what happens with the detectors if you're looking like Minkowski space-time
right.
and Rindler's space.
Yeah, right. Right.
What
right.
I think, I mean, what I'm just puzzled about is like, if you do everything with inertial detection, but let's say that your detector will be an atom and you prepare one of
right.
those things.
Right.
Then, well, everything would be nice. Different inertial atoms would measure
right.
the same thing. But if then you go into a accelerated
right,
atom,
right.
then states that were pure before, like vacuums that start being mixed states, and some funny things like that. And actually, there's no work done on what happens, like if you take a cavity and you accelerate it. And I'm working
yeah.
with that with Danny right now. And also with Paul Alsing, what we wanted to do is what happens with a spin half particle when you accelerate that. Because all of the work that's done so far in terms of Ringler observers is what happens when you have a spin particle looped by two different kinds of observers, but actually not when the accelerated one takes this particle in order to make measurements.
Right. So actually, right. That's very interesting. And so, and I would love to see the results of this work. And thank you for bringing that up, because of course, I mean, the canonical. So let me try to use the canonical example of a detector in a grid for a Rindler observer to try to address this question that was raised earlier. If I have an accelerated detector, right, it will detect particles. But what does it look like to a non-accelerated observer? The accelerated, you know, the particles are created in pairs. The accelerated observer detects a particle, right? The non-accelerated observer says, oh, the detector is in vacuum, but it's accelerated, it clicked, and it emitted a particle, right? Now, in my frame, the person in the accelerated frame, hey, said, my detector clicked, and look, it detected a particle. And I, in my inertial frame, says, hey, your detector clicked, and it emitted a particle. But what we agree on is the detector clicked, okay? That's why this is a scalar quantity in the absence of non-unitary effects. Yeah.
I'd just like to clarify in my own mind. So in that case, the agreement was because people agree on the detector variable. Is there a
right.
stronger claim being made here that just given a region of space, time, and a quantum state, there's some well-defined notion to the number of ops that occur?
Yeah, yeah. So right.
Because
exactly.
that I'm confused on because I can see that there's a well-defined distinction between very initial states, let's say the initial boundary of the region and the
right.
final boundary, whether they're orthogonal or not, that's quite a good
right,
reason.
Right,
but
right.
that's only one op.
Right.
So you're talking about some density of op, or how many op got you from that one state to that other orthogonal state. And
right.
that could depend on the way you slice the region. Because right, I mean, you just have to go from one state to an orthogonal state. You can go by a direct route,
yeah.
or you can go by a very indirect route, and it seems that a lot of ops occur.
Right.
In other states I'm talking about. And that could, that whether you call it direct or indirect, might depend on how you slice the region up. How you totally
you know, region. You know, it's very complicated, because you can show that recoil effects, no matter how heavy is the detector, mm-hmm. always count, and the thing just slips. From hyperbola to hyperbola,
right,
and
right.
so there's no single simple set of Rindler coordinates.
Yeah.
They're changing all the time from your
right.
point of view. So what Raphael says, it's highly relevant.
No, I agree that's relevant. So let me clarify more what I mean by a pop, right? And I'll just one. Sorry, my chairman is.
Yeah, as time as a scholar, we have abused you enough, Seth.
Yeah, well,
can answer that one.
Yeah, let me answer this one, and then well, we can stop. So, so it's actually slightly subtle, and it's related to the question that was raised before about what does this mean? This, you know, this factor of number of ops per second. Well, it's gone now. One of the right there. What does this mean? This number of ops per second. So, an op occurs when some subsystem, okay, like a bit or a clock, moves from one state to an orthogonal state. Okay, so it's not just the system as a whole moving from one state to an orthogonal state. It's a piece of the system, which is defined. So you divide the system up into subsystems, which corresponds to a tensor product of commuting operators. Those commuting operators define these local Hilbert spaces, and then an op is when one of these local Hilbert spaces goes from one state to an orthogonal state. So I certainly wouldn't regard, because I haven't proved anything, I just argued kind of like Bekenstein-like level for this. So what I would say to try to make that more precise is that any decomposition of the system into subsystems, where you follow the number of, you know, bit flips or clock ticks of these subsystems moving from one state to an orthogonal state, the total number of such flips, of such bit flips or clock ticks has to be less than that. Because remember, and this is very important as well, I have assumed here that the energy of the ground state is the same as the gravitational energy, right? Let's remember this. Okay, so this is a big assumption, which is important to bring up before it's done. So it might be that the gravitational energy, you know, that the vacuum has a positive energy, in which case I would do less problem with this. Or it might well be the vacuum has a negative energy, in which case I might be able to do better with this. Right. So let me just conclude by saying this is great feedback. I actually agree with almost everything that has been said. I agree with many more things that you'd said than you agreed with things that I said. And I got lots of feedback to try to figure out how to make this more precise in terms of making covariant, in terms of dealing with these issues of horizons and stuff. Let me just say that at least at the, I hope that at the hand-waving level, or the like the back of the envelope level, because this is indeed just a back of the envelope calculation, it makes some sense that when you're trying to measure space-time using quantum mechanical systems, that the interaction between these quantum mechanical systems and gravity, here just at, you know, a very macroscopic, semi-classical way, puts limits to the accuracy with which you could measure the resolution with which you can resolve the geometry in some four volume of space-time. And I would conjecture or claim, let me just claim it, I would claim that this quantum geometric limit is an expression of that. And it would be the covariant analog of Rousseau version of holography, like the covariant entropy, is TBD, or to be determined. Right. But this is my suggestion, right? This part is, I think, pretty obvious. Just how to define this extremal world sheet. Perhaps we should say that you take any world sheet, you project these particles on the density of these ops, it can be no greater than the Planck scale. Maybe that's another way of saying it. Okay. Thank you very much for your excellent audience participation. It's been a lot of fun.